Hey, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 241. And welcome. This is the last lecture. It's December 9th. And we're going to finish up respiratory and go into renal physiology a little bit. I want to discuss some of the important figures in renal physiology, but I probably won't talk anything about the anatomy because you know everything about the anatomy of the kidney and nephron already. But if you want to review it with me, then during office hours would be a good time, or maybe after class. All right, but also, next time on the 11th, Thursday, is your last exam. And let's see, it's going to be on 13-14, that's cardiac, blood flow, blood pressure, 16, which is respiratory physiology, 17, which is renal, and 20. All right, but 20 is just that one exam figure and some questions at the end of the chapter. All right, so that's the study guide for chapter 20. And I don't think I'm going to be able to go over that figure today, but you get to draw it in lab on a blank piece of paper. So just have that picture in your mind when you try to answer those questions about how hormones regulate the ovarian cycle and uterine cycle. But if you have some questions, maybe we can go over some questions after that. Okay. All right, so there is an extra credit drawing today and Thursday in lab. And this is the last time you'll be able to change your lab grade. So make sure your lab grades in Blackboard are correct, because after lab this week, I won't go back and correct a mistake. All right, so that's just your responsibility to make sure that all your grades in Blackboard are correct. There's one section that I don't have all the grades for. That could be a problem. I'll try and get them. I'll get them hopefully after class today, for today's lab. But the Thursday's labs, I think all your grades are up to date. So make sure that you get those to me before your last test, right? Because if they're wrong, I can't submit a grade change, right? Because somebody made a goof in putting your grades in there, and that will trigger an audit. So I won't put administration and records through that. So just double check, make sure those are there. Then for the final, all right, then you need your picture ID. Please don't leave your picture ID loose around some place where you're going to lose it, because you won't be able to show me later next week. I won't be around, and then I don't know what to do. I don't know what kind of grade to give you. Hope I might have to give you a zero or something on the test. So make sure you bring your picture ID when you turn your test in next time. Okay? All right, so that's pretty much the schedule, what chapters are on your last exam. And so let me finish up some comments about the respiratory system. And this is where we left off last time. What about some of the previous slides? Oh, here's an exam figure. All right, so how does the brain become aware of the pH in your body? Can acid from your circulatory system just diffuse into the brain where there are pH receptors? No. Okay, so what can diffuse through the blood-brain barrier? Yeah, carbon dioxide. Now, wait a second. Carbon dioxide and hydrogen ions, those are two totally different things. How is that related? Why is monitoring CO2 a way to monitor pH of something? I don't understand. How does that happen? It doesn't happen, huh? How does that happen? Okay, it shows you on this slide how it happens, right? All right, because carbon dioxide can't combine with water to make carbonic acid can dissociate into bicarbonate and hydrogen ions, right? And hydrogen ion is what we use to come up with a pH number, right? pH is just the measure of hydrogen ions in solution, the concentration of hydrogen ions in solution. All right, so CO2 can diffuse into the cerebrospinal fluid. Bicarbonate can't, because it's an ion, can't diffuse through that barrier. And when CO2 enters cerebrospinal fluid, it can interconvert with hydrogen ions and bicarbonate because there is no free energy change. It can go forwards and backwards. Even though these arrows are single-ended, you should probably draw in a double-ended arrow right here, right? So there should be an arrow point here, right, and maybe an arrow point here because these species can convert into each other. Now, how is this, what law says which way this reaction is going to go? Well, the Le Chatelier's principle, maybe. Did I hear that? I think I heard Laplace. Well, that's close. all right, or the law of mass action, all right, if you don't like French, law of mass action. And what speeds up this reaction? What makes this reaction fast? An enzyme. That's right, an enzyme. And you have to know the name of that enzyme as well, because it's so important, because it helps regulate pH of your body through respiration. And you know, remember the name of that enzyme? Carbonic anhydrase. I think we even had that on the first exam and have talked about it. All right, so CO2 diffuses out of the blood, converted into protons in cerebral spinal fluid, and then we have neurons in the brain that can monitor the pH, right? pH from hydrogen ions in the cerebral spinal fluid, and that comes from CO2 that's in your body. All right, so respiration is going to be controlled by some compounds in your body, for instance, like carbon dioxide and oxygen, right? Because mitochondria need oxygen. They produce CO2. You want to get rid of that. So what molecule do you think would be more important to monitor in your body, the waste product CO2 or oxygen, which is a compound the mitochondria need to make ATP? Which do you think would be better to monitor? Wow, you guys, it took me decades to realize that. Yeah, it's CO2. It's not oxygen. I always would guess that it would be oxygen, because without oxygen, right, you're going to die. But it is CO2. So the rate and depth of respiration in our bodies is controlled mostly by CO2 concentration. And I think one way to realize that is because that has the most direct effect on pH inside your body. And remember, enzymes have an optimal pH at which they work, so small changes in pH can make huge changes in the biochemistry inside our cells. So CO2 changes our biochemistry very quickly, and so that's why our bodies mostly monitor CO2. And that's what this graph here shows us, right? It compares pCO2 and PO2 effects on ventilation. Remember, this P stands for partial pressure. You could think of that as like the concentration of this compound in a gas, right? But it's not a solute in a liquid. It's just another gas in a mixture of gases. So we call that the partial pressure. All right, so we're looking at respiratory rate. We call that total minute volume. So how much volume we breathe in and out of our lungs in 1 minute. That's the minute volume in liters per minute. And then our horizontal axis, right, when we go from left to right, we have decreasing oxygen, right? So as this oxygen decreases, that should stimulate ventilation, right? The top axis right here, again, horizontal, as CO2, in this case, doesn't decrease, what? It increases. So increases in CO2, right, will increase ventilation. That's what we see, right? So increasing CO2 or decreasing oxygen have a direct effect on ventilation. But which one is more important? And you can see that on this graph. So if we look at carbon dioxide, here's the carbon dioxide graph. So we want to use the top scale up over here. All right, so if we increase the concentration or percentage of CO2, if we double it, if we go from 4, all right, to 8, how does our respiration change? It goes from about 20 liters up to 60 liters. Per minute, right? So the change is 40 liters of ventilation per minute. Now, what would happen if we were to cut the concentration of oxygen in half? What would happen to ventilation? All right, so here we are at 12. If we cut that in half, 6, what's the change in ventilation? It's like from about 10 to maybe 20 or 10 liters per minute. All right, so changes in oxygen concentration don't have much of an effect on ventilation or the urgency to breathe. It's a change in CO2 because it's so tightly can be converted into acid inside our body. All right, so you can appreciate that from this graph right here. Here is an important reflex, Herring-Brewer reflex, and it's in our bodies because our lung tissue is very delicate. And it's very elastic, it's highly compliant, so small changes in pressure can change large volumes inside the lungs. So additional changes in pressure could actually damage the lungs. So there are stretch receptors in the lungs, and they get stimulated the more that the lung stretches, more action potentials are sent to the respiratory centers. and those action potentials will inhibit respiration. So when our lungs are fully inflated, there are a lot of action potentials going to the respiratory center, and that inhibits further inspiration. All right, so the Herring-Brewer reflex is there. What does the Herring-Brewer reflex protect? What does it protect? Our lungs from overinflation, right? And overinflated lungs can be damaged. They can rip. Right? So the Herring-Brewer reflex is important so that you can't overinhale. All right. Well, we get gas in our lungs, and that oxygen is carried by the blood. Not very much oxygen can dissolve in plasma. And so there has to be another way oxygen is transported. And it's transported on a molecule we call hemoglobin. Hemoglobin is found inside red blood cells. So the loading of hemoglobin with oxygen occurs in the lungs, of course, because relatively deoxygenated blood goes to the lungs to pick up oxygen. And then unloading of that oxygen takes place in capillaries, systemic capillaries, bringing oxygen to those tissues. And we're going to see that the affinity of oxygen for hemoglobin changes according to a number of physiologic variables. So could you think of a physiologic variable before I show you any of this stuff? What's a physiologic variable? How about pH? Yeah, we saw that how important that was on the previous graph because of CO2 concentration. What about temperature? Is your temperature regulated? Or does your temperature change all over the place? No, it's regulated, so that's a physiologic variable. Okay, and even oxygen concentration, right? So here is that hemoglobin molecule, and we can see the tertiary structure of this molecule. There are actually four chains. Here is the heme group. Now, when you look at this heme group, can you tell me, is this an organic or an inorganic compound? Yeah, it's a nice organic compound because we have carbons that are covalently bound to hydrogen, so this is a nice organic compound. But it is neither a lipid, a protein, a carbohydrate, or a nucleic acid. It's just a very important organic compound that can bind an iron atom. Right? And oxygen will bind to this iron atom because it has a nice free electron. It's an ion, and when it's bound to hemoglobin, it's usually in the +2 state, so it has an electron that oxygen likes to pair up with. Right? And so, since there are four chains that make up a hemoglobin molecule, how many oxygens can one hemoglobin molecule carry? It can carry four, right? Because there are four atoms of iron in this molecule. Well, how does that change oxygen carrying capacity of the fluid that's coursing through our body, which is blood? Well, we need to take some oxygen. Here I have a cylinder that's pressurized, and the partial pressure of oxygen is 100 millimeters of mercury coming out through this regulator, and that oxygen or that air mixture with oxygen at 100 millimeters of mercury, right, is bubbled through plasma and then also whole blood. And you should be aware of what the difference is. Whole blood has red blood cells, plasma has no cells. And if we let that equilibrate over a long period of time, we see that there is some oxygen, right, dissolved in these two fluids. And when we measure, okay, the oxygen concentration in this fluid, it's going to equal the partial pressure of the oxygen that we're bubbling through the solution. So the pressure of oxygen dissolved in solution is going to be 100 millimeters of mercury if it's plasma, and it's going to be 100 millimeters of mercury even if it's whole blood. That is just for oxygen dissolved in each of these two kinds of fluids. But where else do we see oxygen in whole blood? It is also bound to these hemoglobin molecules. So not only do you have oxygen dissolved in solution here, but you have oxygen also bound to hemoglobin. And so that increases the oxygen that we see in the right-hand compartment compared to the left. And if we measure that oxygen, this is what we get. All right, for plain old plasma, it can carry 0.3 mLs of oxygen for every 100 mLs of plasma, so 0.3. That's what's dissolved in here. If we're going to measure it in terms of a volume, and of course that volume has to be at standard temperature and pressure, right? That's how we need to measure gases. And over here, we see that there are 20 milliliters of oxygen for every 100 mLs of blood. And so what is that? How many more times oxygen can whole blood carry compared to plasma? Well, if it was 10 times, then it would be 3 milliliters, right? So it's almost 100 times as much if there is hemoglobin or if there are red blood cells compared to if there are no red blood cells. So red blood cells are incredibly important for delivering oxygen to our tissues. All right, some forms of hemoglobin. Right, methemoglobin contains a ferric iron, which is plus 3. That's an oxidized form. How do you oxidize something? It has something to do with electrons. What do you have to do with a compound with electrons to oxidize it? You take off electrons, right? Okay, so the ferrous iron that can carry oxygen is oxidized, so when you take an electron away, it becomes iron in the plus 3 state. That's the oxidized form. It lacks that electron to bind oxygen, and so that methemoglobin is can't carry oxygen in your body. And there's always some, right? But it's a very, very small amount. Right? There's another compound called carboxyhemoglobin. There's another compound besides oxygen that can bind to heme, and that is carbon monoxide. And I think you know what carbon monoxide is. I could draw it on the board, but it's just what? CO. And where does carbon monoxide come from? From fire, from combustion, right, of compounds, gasoline, wax and candles, gas to run our stove, right, even natural gas to run our furnaces produce carbon monoxide, right? And when it binds to hemoglobin, forming carboxyhemoglobin, then it takes the same spot where oxygen is going to bind. So when hemoglobin is bound to carbon monoxide, oxygen can't bind to it, so then oxygen can't be delivered to your tissues. So when you're breathing carbon monoxide, that is like somebody putting their hands around your throat and choking you, right? Because oxygen can't get to your tissues. And carbon monoxide is really deadly because it's odorless and colorless, so we can't detect if it's in our environment. And then here's the really bad thing. It has an affinity for hemoglobin that is 210 times stronger than the association with oxygen. Right? So the treatment for carbon monoxide poisoning is to put somebody in a high oxygen concentration atmosphere, and then oxygen can bump off that carbon monoxide. So if we have that heme, so we got heme with carbon monoxide bound to it, right? We can get rid of this carbon monoxide by putting somebody in an atmosphere that is high in oxygen. Right? So how many of these oxygen molecules would I have to draw so that we can have just equal concentrations of oxyhemoglobin and this one right here? How many oxygens would I have to draw? I'd have to draw 210 of them. Right, 210, just to have a 50-50 equilibrium. Right, so that just shows you that very small concentrations of carbon monoxide are extremely poisonous. And this association lasts for a long time, so there can be a very small concentration of carbon monoxide for a long time that will be just as poisonous as a higher concentration of carbon monoxide for a short period of time. All right, so that is a way of poisoning somebody. Okay, well, let's look at delivering oxygen to tissues. And here we have a table, right? And it just shows how the percent oxyhemoglobin, that's the amount of hemoglobin that is bound to oxygen, how that changes as the partial pressure of oxygen changes in a gas mixture. Right, and so here we see a decreasing partial pressure of oxygen as we go from left to right. And also, how does that relate to the percent oxyhemoglobin? Right, as you go from left to right, it decreases as well. So how would you describe that relationship? Sorry, I want to go to this view right here. Sorry. How would you describe that relationship? It's directly related, right? As the partial pressure of oxygen decreases, then the percent oxyhemoglobin in solution decreases, right? And it just so happens that arterial blood has about 100 millimeters of mercury, partial pressure of oxygen, And when it's at that pressure, almost all of the hemoglobin finds oxygen, 97%, 98%, almost 100%. So in arterial blood, how much hemoglobin is bound to oxygen? Almost all of it, really close to 100%. Okay? And then as his blood travels through capillaries and then goes into the venous system, your body takes some oxygen out. The partial pressure of oxygen decreases to 40. Right? And now what is the percent oxyhemoglobin? Of all the hemoglobin, now only 75% is bound to oxygen. So what does that mean? That means that the difference in this percentage is the amount of oxygen that was actually delivered to the tissues. Right? So it's like there's a big 25% oxyhemoglobin change. So that's the amount that's delivered to tissues. Well, when you look at these numbers, it's a little confusing. So if you got a table of numbers, one way to understand what's happening is to make a graph out of it, right? And so here is a graph of that previous table. And indeed, we see that the percent oxyhemoglobin increases as the partial pressure of oxygen increases, right? But it's not a pure straight line, but nonetheless, you can see the direct relationship right there. This is more like a sigmoidal curve. So we said that arteries have a pressure of 100, veins have a pressure of 40, and so how much oxygen is actually delivered to the tissues? Right, so we look over here, oxygen content in blood in terms of volume of oxygen at standard temperatures and pressures for every 100 mLs of blood, and we see that it changes from arterial supply of 20 mLs down to 15, right, at the venous end, by looking at these points right here. So how much oxygen is unloaded to the tissues for a certain volume of blood? It's going to be 5 mLs for every 100 mLs of blood. So that's a large number. So here is an exam figure. All right, so I will want you to know what is the figure for what's the partial pressure of blood in an artery, what's the partial pressure of oxygen in a vein. All right, so you should be able to label this graph. So that's the important thing about this graph. It shows you how much oxygen is delivered to tissues. All right, here's another table. We're going to plot some of this out in just a little bit. But now this table shows how the affinity of oxygen changes according to what physiologic parameter as it changes. I see it right here. The first call, pH. Yeah. So when pH changes, this saturation curve also changes. It's not always constant. All right, so here is pH of 7.4. Is that normal or is that acidic or basic in our human body? It's normal, right? Okay. And so if we become more alkaline, so the pH number increases 7.6, but if we go from 7.4 and become more acidic, we can see that in 7.2. Right? So 7.2 is acidic compared to 7.4. And if we look at the affinity and saying that the normal pH, we have normal affinity, if we become more basic, then the affinity increases. If we become acidic, the affinity decreases as a result of that. And if we look at the amount of oxygen in arteries and veins, right, because the partial pressures are going to be a little bit different. Look at what happens. All right, so we just saw in that previous graph that under normal conditions, 5 mLs of oxygen is delivered to tissues. And as we become basic, what happens to the amount of oxygen delivered to tissues? Does it stay the same? It decreases. All right, so is that a good thing when oxygen delivery decreases? No, that's not very helpful. All right, but what happens when we become acidic? All right, now you have 6.6 mLs delivered to tissues compared to 5. So you have extra delivery of oxygen to tissues, right, when tissues become acidic. What is one way that our tissues can become acidic, like a muscle? What is one way? You got to think all the way back to respiration chapter. Yeah, like for exercise. When you exercise a muscle, it produces lactic acid, pH drops. And when a muscle is exercising, does it make sense to have increased oxygen delivery to that muscle, or should oxygen delivery decrease to an exercising muscle? it should increase, right? Because that oxygen is necessary to make ATP. ATP is necessary for those filaments to slide. And indeed, as tissues become more acidic, then hemoglobin has a better ability to deliver oxygen to the tissues. So if we look at these curves, so we said pH 7.4 is normal. Here is that normal binding curve. Here it is when you become acidic. Now what side, 7.2, what side is this 7.2 pH on compared to the normal? Is it shifted to the right or to the left? It's shifted to the right, right? And we said that increases oxygen delivery to tissues. And if you look at the graph over here, you can see that, right? Regardless of what the pH is, the binding in the arterial supply, what did we say arterial was? About 100 millimeters of mercury, right? It's still about 100%, but if you go down to 40, which is at the venous end, you can see that the lower pH has a lower content of oxygen in veins, which means then that it delivers more oxygen to those tissues. All right, so anytime you see this oxygen saturation curve and it's shifted to the right, that shows you that there is additional delivery of oxygen to tissues. Right, so a right shift is additional delivery of oxygen to tissues. And if this normal curve is shifted to the left, there's what? Decreased oxygen delivery to tissue. So what we want to see to maintain homeostasis is right shifting of this saturation curve. All right, well, when we go hiking up in the mountains, or if we live at a high altitude, there's less oxygen in the air, right? And so hemoglobin is going to have trouble picking up oxygen to deliver to tissues, but there is some compensatory mechanism, right, to help oxygen delivery in our body. So we're going to look at this flow diagram. So with low partial pressure of oxygen as we go up in altitude, that means there's less oxyhemoglobin, right? And oxyhemoglobin inhibits the production of this thing we call 2,3-diphosphoglycerate. This is intermediate in glycolysis, right? So it can be produced with just enzymes inside the red blood cell. And as oxyhemoglobin decreases, right, then the inhibition of producing this compound goes away. So red blood cells, when oxygen is low, start to produce a lot of 2,3-DPG. All right, and what the heck? So 2,3-DPG increases inside the cell under low oxygen conditions, and 2,3-DPG interacts with hemoglobin. It lowers the affinity of oxygen to hemoglobin, which is another way of saying that 2,3-DPG produces a right shift in the oxygen saturation curve, right? And if there is a right shift, what does that do? Does it increase or decrease oxygen delivery or unloading of oxygen in tissues? If it's right shifted, increases oxygen delivery to tissues. Oh, and that's what we have right here, increase O2 unloading in the tissues, right? When 2,3-DPG increases in concentration. Well, what was the stimulus? Low PO2 at high altitude, right? So here we have increased oxygen unloading in tissues, and that, does that add to or subtract from less oxygen delivery to the tissues, right? If there's a right shift, that subtracts from, so this is a nice negative feedback mechanism. All right, so on this table right here, we see, there's something that we haven't talked about. We have another parameter, and that is temperature. So as our blood becomes more acidic, like for instance in tissues, in an exercising muscle, it becomes acidic. That shifts the curve to the right and delivers more oxygen to tissues. As 2,3-DPG concentration increases, that shifts the curve to the right. And one last item right here, increased temperature also causes a right shift. So does that make sense? What happens to a muscle when it starts to exercise? Does the temperature change? Absolutely, right? You start sweating. That's nice direct proof that your body temperature increases. And as your muscle temperature increases, what happens to oxygen delivery? It's higher because that saturation curve is shifted to the right. So under these physiologic conditions that can change, right, we can see, and they change During exercise, for instance, that will increase oxygen unloading in tissues in particular. All right, so just remember, right shift is increased oxygen delivery to tissues. When pH decreases, or when blood becomes more acidic, that decreases the affinity. We call that the Bohr effect. All right, so the Bohr effect describes how you have increased delivery of oxygen to tissues when those tissues become acidic, like during exercise, for instance. So probably you've run into a couple of questions with that Bohr effect. Okay. So anytime you see that right shift, here we have, I want to talk about this just for a little bit. Here we have some normal red blood cells on the left. It has normal hemoglobin. The four chains are normal. Here are some red blood cells, and they have an abnormal hemoglobin. Two of those four subunits have an amino acid that's different in one location. And so it has a tendency to clump together. And when those molecules clump together in a different way compared to normal, it changes the shape of these red blood cells. And you can see these red blood cells are not nice and smooth and round surfaces and flat. Okay, they're elongated, and what can you tell me about the edges? They got points to them, right? So they're a lot longer than a normal red blood cell, and they have these little spikes on them. We call these sickle cells, right? And when somebody has that kind of hemoglobin that produces these cells, we call that sickle cell anemia. So after a cell sickle like this, they also have a tendency to lyse, right? Your body gets rid of them, and that's what produces the anemia. The other thing that's really bad is that these cells cannot flow through small blood vessels like capillaries. They get stuck. So they create occlusions in small blood vessels, so blood can't get to tissues via those small blood vessels, and those tissues then basically starve to death because they don't have oxygen. All right, so that's a terrible condition. And have you ever had a muscle that was working but didn't have oxygen delivered to it? How did that feel? Can anybody think of a circumstance where you had a muscle where oxygen wasn't getting to it? And how did it feel? Yeah, we want to get to how does that feel. Well, how can you produce a situation where a muscle is no longer getting oxygen, even if you have normal red blood cells? You can put a cuff on somebody's arm, right? Or you can contract a muscle and keep it contracted for a long period of time. When that muscle is contracted, blood can't get into it because it's just turned into this immense solid object right here. Blood can't get into it. And when does that happen? When you have a muscle spasm or a cramp, all right? Now, can you relate? Who's had a muscle cramp in here? Raise your hand really quick. Probably everybody has. Right? Maybe people that didn't raise their hand right now have a cramp in their shoulder or something and couldn't raise it. Okay. Well, how did that feel? All right. So here you have this muscle that's cramping, and are you really proud of that muscle? Saying, "Oh, look how big that is! I exercise it every day." Are you impressed with yourself, and are you trying to impress others? Or what are you doing? What are you doing with that muscle? Okay, you're probably dancing around, you're probably moving other muscles. You would do anything to get that muscle spasm to do what? To go away. Because how does it feel when you have a muscle cramp? It hurts like hell, right? It's really, really painful. Okay, so somebody in sickle cell anemia, right, is feeling that sensation not just in one muscle, but pretty much in muscles all over their body. So that's a really painful circumstance. And what can you do for somebody that's in that amount of pain? Or what should a healthcare provider do for somebody that's in that kind of pain? Okay. You can give them something to bite on, I suppose. I see that in the movies a lot, but we don't do that anymore in hospitals. We give them opiates to deal with that pain. Okay, so people in sickle cell crisis or sickle cell anemia need pain management, and this is a condition that happens to them all the time. So you might see some patients that will be asking for opiates, not every day, but maybe every week, every couple days. And, oh, gee whiz, what do you think of somebody that is asking for opiates numerous times during the week? you might consider them a substance abuser, right? Well, make sure you never confuse somebody that's a substance abuser with somebody that needs, right, pain medication for important serious conditions like sickle cell anemia. All right, so don't confuse those two different populations of patients. And indeed, right, if somebody is a substance abuser, you do have to be careful with yourself because you never really know what they're going to do to kind of feed that habit. But somebody that needs opiates to control pain, that's a totally different kind of situation, right? All right, so that's something about sickle cell anemia. And that's how oxygen is transported in your body via hemoglobin, because not very much oxygen just dissolves in plasma by itself. Well, what other gas has to be transported in blood besides oxygen? Yeah, carbon dioxide. Well, it just so happens that the blood or the plasma can hold a lot of carbon dioxide. All right, carbon dioxide can dissolve in water, can dissolve in plasma. All right, so here we have some tissues that are producing CO2 because they're metabolically active. That CO2 diffuses into the blood, and let's look and see where this carbon dioxide goes. 10% can dissolve in plasma. That's a lot more than oxygen, but that's still not very much. There's still 90% that has to be transported some other way. And so carbon dioxide can diffuse into these red blood cells, and some of that carbon dioxide can combine to hemoglobin, right, producing that carbamamino hemoglobin. So another 20% can be carried by hemoglobin like oxygen can, right? So that's 30%. Well, that leaves 70% unaccounted for, which is what? Most of it. So what happens to the rest of that CO2? Well, it diffuses into the cell, can combine with water to produce carbonic acid. That carbonic acid then can dissociate into bicarbonate and hydrogen ions. And you know the name of the enzyme? Carbonic acid. Carbonic anhydrase speeds up the rate of this reaction, right? And so now you have hydrogen ions inside the cell. This bicarbonate can diffuse out from the cell into plasma. But remember, that's an ion, so if a negative charge leaves the cell to maintain the cell membrane potential the same, then a chloride has to enter. Right? And so we call that the chloride shift, when bicarbonate comes out of the cell. And bicarbonate, I don't know what the solubility is exactly with bicarbonate, but it would be, for instance, very similar to dissolving salt in water or sugar. Right? Can you dissolve a lot of sugar in water? Yeah, it just goes right into solution, right? So 70% of CO2 is transported in the blood as bicarbonate ion. And that's how it's transported. So this is in the tissue. So now you have bicarbonates, right? And blood ends up in the lungs. And then what happens? Well, there's very low concentration of carbon dioxide in the alveoli. So carbon dioxide diffuses from plasma into the alveoli. That stimulates the unloading of carbon dioxide from hemoglobin. It dissociates, right? And then carbon dioxide diffuses down its concentration gradient, so you're getting rid of carbon dioxide that way, right? Just down concentration gradients. And when CO2 disappears from inside the cell, guess what that does to the carbonic anhydrase reaction? Right? It forces it to, in this particular case, forces it to the left, right? So this red blood cell, with the action of carbonic anhydrase, is going to combine bicarbonate with hydrogen ion, making carbonic acid, and then that's going to dissociate to make carbon dioxide and water. All right, so that bicarbonate then is converted into CO2. CO2 then will diffuse down that concentration gradient. So this is the reverse effect in the lungs compared to systemic capillaries. And that's all really nice and handy because of two things, Le Chatelier's principle and carbonic anhydrase. Okay, something else that is sort of interesting. What happens if you, don't have a lot of time. What happens if you hyperventilate? Let's say you hyperventilate and you get rid of a lot of CO2. If you exhale very quickly, so the rate and depth of expiration increases, right? The CO2 in your blood is going to decrease, right? Because you're going to get rid of a lot of CO2. What happens to the pH of blood when you do that? Let's take away this CO2. What's going to happen according to Le Chatelier's principle? If we get rid of this CO2, what's going to happen? Okay. Well, because of Le Chatelier's principle, right? Bicarbonate and hydrogen ion are going to combine to try to replace that CO2 that's lost, right? And when bicarbonate and hydrogen ions combine to make CO2, this hydrogen ion goes away. So you have less hydrogen ion concentration in the blood. What kind of condition does that produce? An acidosis or an alkalosis? Alkalosis, right? So just respiratory rate can help adjust the pH inside your body. If you hyperventilate, the pH decreases, right, because of that carbonic anhydrase reaction. And so one way of thinking of this is that when you hyperventilate, it's like breathing what out of your body? We're like aliens when we breathe out. What are we really breathing out of our body? It's CO2, but it, right, indirectly is acid. Right, when we exhale, we're breathing acid out of our body because of this chemical reaction right here. That's why I accused all of you of being like aliens, right? But we don't hardly recognize that, but it's something that's very important. So hyperventilation produces an alkalosis. When you hold your breath, that produces carbon dioxide, which produces an acidosis. We call those respiratory alkalosis or respiratory acidosis, just depending on your ventilation rate. Okay. All right, so that's it for the respiratory chapter. So just remember, when you have an oxygen saturation curve shifted to the right, does that enhance or decrease oxygen delivery to tissues? Right shift? Enhances, right. And we see that with increased temperature, decreased pH, or increases of 2-3 dpg, what happens when we start to increase altitude. Okay, so somebody living in Mexico City, what happens to their blood? They're living up in the mountains. I forget how high they are, probably 7,000 feet maybe, Mexico City. What happens to their 2-3 dpg concentration when somebody lives way up in the mountains like that? 2-3 dpg increases. Does that help them out? Yes, because that shifts their oxygen saturation curve to the right. That helps unloading of oxygen from tissues, right? And that change can happen relatively quickly compared to building more red blood cells in somebody's body. All right, that's it for respiratory chapter. All right, so I want to mention some things with regard to the urinary system. So let's take a look and see. I can make a couple comments with the urinary system. All right, well, what are the gross structures of the urinary system? We can all agree on that. Right, it's kidneys, right? And that produces urine. And that urine that the kidneys produce, and you know what? Kidneys have to produce urine 24 hours a day, every second. And if they don't produce urine, then they die. And no one ever wants to get rid of their kidneys, so we got to produce urine all the time. But we don't void that urine from our body, right, all the time. What happens to that urine? Oh, I got to get my cursor back. Let's see. How do I do that? Okay. So kidneys are producing urine all the time, right? And does anybody know what the structural and functional unit of urine formation is called? That's a nephron, right? So that's a microscopic structure, and those are located in the kidney producing urine. Then that urine, right, leaves the nephron and it goes into something called a calyx. Is that ringing a bell? Right, at the tip of every renal pyramid, there's a calyx. That's a collecting basin for urine, and that's what we call a minor calyx. When two minor calyces come together, we call that a major calyx. When major calyces come together, it forms a funnel structure right here that we call the pelvis, right? And that funnels urine into the ureter. That's where I wanted to go with that whole big long discussion, right? So the structures are, we got kidney, we got ureter that takes urine to the urinary bladder, which is right here. Don't get confused with, oh, what's this thing right here? What's that thing right there? Anybody recognize that? That's a uterus. Okay, don't get confused with the urinary bladder. So here we have the ureters going into urinary bladder. All right, so that is a container for urine. So it's getting filled up all the time until there's a proper time to void, and then urine leaves the body via the urethra. So you got kidney, ureter, urinary bladder, urethra. So that's a nice simple system. All right, but well, what does the kidney do for you when it's producing urine?
maybe I have it on a slide right here. Okay. Well, it removes waste products, metabolic waste products from plasma. It can adjust the concentration of sodium and potassium and even bicarbonate and other kind of ions in your body. And is sodium and potassium ion, are they important for anything that you know of inside your body? Yeah, like name one thing that sodium is important for. Yeah, blood pressure. I'm thinking of even something more simple, something even more basic. How about membrane potential? Yes, right? Sodium and potassium will determine what the membrane potential is, and that voltage across the membrane has to be there. Otherwise, that cell is dead, just like a battery is, right? So kidneys do that. It helps regulate pH because it can secrete hydrogen ions into filtrate. And it's also going to adjust the fluid volume inside your body. And that adjusts the plasma volume. And what can you tell? How is the volume of blood related to something in your body? In terms of like blood pressure. Right? If you increase blood volume, what happens to blood pressure? It increases. A nice way, quick way to think about that, think of your car tire. If the pressure is low, do you put air in or take air out? Yeah, you got to put air in. You put fluid into your cardiovascular system, your blood pressure goes up. So that analogy with a car tire is almost a bad analogy in a physiology class because you should know a little bit more about why your blood pressure goes up. If your blood volume goes up, why does your blood pressure go up? Because, yeah, you have more blood. You have more blood going back to the heart. Your heart fills up with more blood. What happens to a normal heart when it stretches more? Well, this is a really good concept for you to follow. As the heart stretches more, what happens to the function of the heart? Does it get weaker or stronger, or does it stay the same? You know what? It gets stronger, and you should know the name of that principle. It's an intrinsic property of the heart. It's called the Frank Starling Law of the Heart. That's right. So as your blood volume increases, your end-diastolic volume increases, that means the force of contraction increases when you have a nice normal heart. That's the Frank Starling Law. As your heart gets stronger, stroke volume increases. And how is stroke volume related to blood pressure? It's nice, directly related. Remember, blood pressure is equal stroke volume times heart rate times the resistance, total peripheral resistance, right? So adjusting blood volume is a way to control your blood pressure. And kidneys are really good at doing that over the long term. Not short term, but long term regulation of blood pressure. And you know the mechanism for that. What's the most important mechanism for long term regulation of blood pressure? Yeah, that renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system. What's the short-term, important short-term regulation? Baroreceptor reflex, right. All right, but we're going to talk about those long-term regulation of blood pressure because we're talking about the kidneys. Okay, well, I'm not going to go over this anatomy. One thing that I do want to go over, maybe we'll just look at a nephron. Here's a nephron. What's a good way to think of a nephron? You want to break it down into two major components. It's made of tubes. There are two major kinds of tubes that make a nephron. There are what we call vascular elements. What kind of fluid is in a vascular element? Because it's a blood vessel. Vascular elements contain blood. And I can see vascular elements like, for instance, here is the afferent arteriole bringing blood into this capillary. What is this capillary that kind of looks like a meatball? This is the glomerulus. It's a very leaky kind of capillary. It's not a continuous capillary. It's a fenestrated capillary, so it's very leaky. Small molecules can leak out. All right, and the remaining blood goes into this efferent arteriole. Right, and what does an arteriole always deliver blood to? Arteriole? Like here is the afferent arteriole. What is it delivering blood to? A capillary. And it's got a fancy name in this case, the glomerulus. Here's another arteriole. It's going to deliver blood to a capillary. Here is the second capillary. These are what we call the peritubular capillaries because they surround all of these tubes. So this efferent arteriole, you should think of that as what kind of blood vessel? Your choices would be artery, vein, or portal vessel. Yeah, because a portal vessel is one that connects two capillary beds back to back before it goes back to the heart. All right, so here's another example of a portal blood vessel in your body, and probably you should be aware of a couple others, like between the hypothalamus and the pituitary gland, remember that portal vessel? Between your digestive organs and your liver, there's a portal blood vessel. Here's another one, for example. Okay, so, and then from this capillary, blood gets back to a venule, and then that goes back to your heart. All right, so those are vascular elements. The other kind of element, anybody remember what the second kind of element that makes up a nephron? It's called a tubular element, right? Tubular element doesn't contain blood, but it contains a fluid that we call filtrate. Okay, so filtrate is produced, where is filtrate produced? In that first tubular element that we call Bowman's capsule. Sometimes it's called the glomerular capsule because it surrounds the glomerulus. And then that filtrate moves from Bowman's capsule into this tube right here. How would you describe this tube? Is it a straight tube? It is not. It is, you could call it a twisted turning tube, but there's a better word for that. That is convoluted. Right? Convoluted means a lot of twists and turns. It's closest to Bowman's capsule. Here's proximal convoluted tubule. And then here's a nephron loop. Here's the descending limb of the loop of Henle. Here's the ascending limb. Then another twisted tubule called the distal convoluted tubule. And then that filtrate empties into the collecting duct. And out of this collecting duct comes urine. So entering is filtrate, leaving is urine. So this nephron processes filtrate into urine in these different locations within the nephron. All right, so make sure you got these tubular elements in your mind compared to the vascular elements. So if you have something infiltrate in this proximal convoluted tubule, right, so it's infiltrate in a tubular element of a nephron, and if we just let it go, don't do any kind of processing, where is it going to end up? If we have stuff infiltrate right here, where is it going to end up? If we don't do anything to it, where is it going to end up? Trace it around. Proximal, descending loop, ascending loop, distal convoluted tubule. Collecting duct. It's going to end up in the collecting duct and then out of the collecting duct. What's that fluid called that's leaving the collecting duct? That's urine. So if we have a substance, right, infiltrate and we don't do anything to it, where's it going to end up? It's going to end up over here. It's going to end up in urine. And then where does urine end up? Outside your body. Right? So if there's something infiltrate and nothing happens to it, it's going to, what, stay in your body or leave your body? It's going to leave your body, right? Okay, so filtrate, when it's processed, produces urine, that stuff leaves your body. Okay, so that's the job of the nephron. Okay, that proximal convoluted tubule, it's just a single layer of cuboidal cells, but the apical surface has microvilli. What's the function of microvilli? In one word? Yeah, increases surface area, increases exchange, right? Surface area and exchange are directly related to each other. All right, so that proximal convoluted tubule is really important for resorbing salt and water and other molecules that your body needs. They're transported from the filtrate to a blood vessel, like the peritubular capillaries. We call that tubular resorption, when something moves from filtrate back into your body. And so the proximal convoluted tubule is working all the time at 100% of its capacity. And in that proximal convoluted tubule, all right, it's going to remove a lot of water from filtrate because we'd be dehydrated if we didn't do that. And it's, what's another thing that we find in filtrate, single transported? Oh, other molecules needed by the body. What's another molecule needed by the body besides sodium, potassium, and water? It's a small molecule. It gets filtered in Bowman's capsule because it's a small molecule, but we don't want to lose it. What's another molecule we don't want to lose? Important energy molecule. It enters glycolysis. What enters glycolysis? It helps us produce ATP. Glucose, for instance. That's right. Glucose is filtered. It goes into filtrate. important energy molecule. Where would that glucose end up if we just left it alone, if it's infiltrate? It would be in urine. Okay. Does that normally happen?
No.
What condition do we notice that happening? Yeah, diabetes mellitus, right? When there's so much glucose in the blood, it can't all be resorbed because there are special transporters that are necessary for that to happen. But when those get saturated, then glucose ends up in the urine, and we call that diabetes mellitus. How did you guys test for that in lab? Or did you yet? Did you do that experiment yet? Maybe today you do urine analysis? I think maybe today you do urine analysis. Yeah, it's very easily done because you just taste urine. And if it's sweet, diabetes mellitus. So you guys get to really look forward to lab this week. Okay. So that proximal convoluted tubule is working 100% of the time, right? And but the nephron will match the water that you would lose in filtrate with the water needs inside your body. That proximal convoluted tubule is working 100% all the time, so that the other more distal parts of the nephron make small adjustments in resorption or secretion to match what your body needs. All right, so just remember, proximal is working to like 100% of its capacity. It's like the all or none response, right, for an action potential. All right, glomerular filtration. What does this process of filtration produce? Yeah? It makes something on the way to becoming urine, but it's not really hard. It's almost like a trick question because it's so easy. The process of filtration produces filtrate. Yeah. Or I could ask you, filtrate is produced by what process? You would say filtration, right? So filtration just works by the size of the molecule. And remember, those glomerular capillaries are fenestrated, which means that they're very leaky. A lot of plasma leaks out of them. And this is just a review from anatomy. You could look at the visceral division of Bowman's capsule as it covers the glomerulus. You can see it's a fenestrated capillary. Okay. Right here. Here's a nice electron micrograph of it. Here's an illustration. All right, so blood comes in. We have small molecules in water that are signified by this little blue thing right here. We also have some proteins, and you see the proteins are a little bit bigger. All right, so what do we see in Bowman's capsule? We see blue particles, which are small. What about, what are these things? Green, brown, orange, don't know. These are big. Do they end up in Bowman's capsule? No, they don't end up. So large molecules and cells don't end up in Bowman's capsule unless the nephron is diseased. Then they can end up. But in a normal nephron, only small molecules are filtered. And so what do we have in Bowman's capsule? We call that filtrate. All right, so how much volume is filtered by both of your kidneys? All right, it's about 150 milliliters per minute. In women, 125 in men. We'll multiply how many minutes are there in a day times that volume, and it turns out to be about 180 liters per day, or 45 gallons. Gee whiz, does that strike you as a lot or not so much? What's 45 gallons a lot? Yeah, it's a lot, right? So you couldn't live at all, right, if you lost 45 gallons of water from your body. As a matter of fact, you couldn't. You don't even, how much blood do you have? You only have 5 liters to begin with, right? Okay, so 45 gallons is produced by these nephrons. So what is that? You would dehydrate in just a couple minutes if that filtrate was lost from your body. So most of that filtered water has to be taken from filtrate and put back into the blood. We call that tubular resorption, all right? And so let's consider that. So 180 liters of filtrate are produced every day. And the rest, I think only about, how much is actually produced? Only 1 to 2 liters of urine is produced in 24 hours. So that 180 minus 1, right, so 179 liters have to be resorbed by the proximal convoluted tubule and that loop of Henle in the distal convoluted tubule. And it varies depending on what the needs of your body are, except for one other limit. We said that kidneys have to produce urine all the time. This is the amount that it has to produce no matter what, or they die. right? It has to produce at least 400 mLs per day, and we call that the obligatory water loss. If you're so dehydrated that your kidneys can't produce 400 mLs per day, then they die. And then eventually, well, you're going to be in really bad shape too when that happens. Okay. So how does that happen? All right, I think this was an exam figure at one point in time. All right, so here's proximal convoluted tubule. I can see some microvilli on the apical surface. What are some of the compartments we're looking at? So here is the epithelium, the wall of that tube. Here we have lumen of a kidney tubule. What do we have in the lumen of a kidney tubule? What kind of fluid is in there? That's filtrate. Yeah, so here we're looking at filtrate. Right here we see some interstitial space, and then here we have a capillary. What's inside this capillary? We've got blood, right? So this blood is really inside your body. All of this stuff in the lumen of a kidney tubule really is outside. If it's left right there, it's going to end up in urine, and you're going to excrete that from your body. Well, we want to not throw away all the sodium that's in this filtrate, and certainly none of the glucose. So how does the sodium and glucose and then even water get back into this capillary? Well, here is, remember, where is sodium at a high concentration? Inside or outside? Outside the cell. So here you have high sodium outside, low sodium inside. So which way will sodium want to move? From outside to in, it will want to move in, right? That's a gradient, that's a potential energy source. And now we have glucose in the filtrate, and it can even be very low concentrations of glucose. It can be high inside the cell. How do we get this glucose going from low concentration to high? What kind of transport mechanism is necessary for that to happen? Yeah, some kind of active transport mechanism. And when you look at this transporter right here in the membrane, do you see ATP? I don't see ATP. What does that mean? What kind of transport is this? Primary or secondary? Secondary active transport. So here you have secondary active transport. Remember, if they're going in the same direction, secondary active transport is called co-transport or symporter mechanism. So that gradient of sodium is used as an energy source to reabsorb all the glucose that's in the filtrate, as long as there isn't too much, as long as somebody doesn't have diabetes mellitus. All right, so that glucose gets inside the cell where it's at high concentration, and here you have glucose low concentration in the blood. Glucose will want to go from high concentration to low, but it usually can't get through the cell membrane. So what has to be in the cell membrane? Some kind of channel or a transporter that allows glucose to diffuse from high concentration to low. When a molecule needs assistance, when you diffuse across, what do we call that process? Facilitated diffusion, which is a form of a passive process, right? Because diffusion is passive. All right, so that's how glucose gets back into your cell. It is an active transport process using that gradient of sodium. Well, how is sodium maintained at a low concentration inside the cell so that this secondary active transport can work? What's working all the time? Okay, diffusion is working. But here is another transporter. What can you tell me about this one? Is it active or passive, or what kind of active? It's primary active transport, because what jumps out at you is ATP, right? So here's that typical sodium-potassium ATP pump that we're really familiar with. It's pumping sodium out of the cell, right? We see it going. And what else has to happen? Potassium enters the cell. Right, so here's the primary active transport mechanism that is supporting this co-transport on the apical surface of this kidney tubule, which allows glucose to be absorbed by the body, so it doesn't end up in urine. All right, the other thing I think that you want to recognize is, what's the direction of sodium and potassium across this membrane? Is it the same? Is it the same direction? Opposite direction. That should remind you of a hormone, right? There's a hormone that increases sodium loss in the body, but it then increases retention of potassium. So sodium and potassium go in opposite directions. And I mentioned that hormone, that's called aldosterone, right? So aldosterone increases sodium loss, but it increases sodium retention. Sodium and potassium go in opposite directions. It's kind of hard to remember unless you know what? Unless you know something about this sodium-potassium pump. Sodium and potassium are going in opposite directions. All right, just all because of that. Okay. All right, 65% of that lost sodium and water is resorbed in the proximal convoluted tubule. Another 20% is resorbed by the descending loop of Henle. And the remainder, right, is resorbed by the distal convoluted tubule and collecting duct, right? And the collecting duct can change how much is reabsorbed depending on the needs of the body. And the energy cost of doing that is 6% of all the calories we consume are used up by the kidneys just to do that, even though our kidneys are really, really small. All right, so let's take a look and see how that, here is an important exam figure. And here we're looking at let's see what the next one looks like. I thought I had it all right here. Oh, good. Okay. Let's look at this one. Okay, so vasorecta. Let's stay right here. Vasorecta. What kind of fluid do we have in a vasorecta? Yeah, blood. You see it's colored red? So here we have a capillary. We see exchange taking place. Vasorecta is in the medulla of a kidney. It's with the juxtaglomerular type of nephron. And this nephron is especially useful in producing urine that is highly concentrated, that has very little water volume and is highly concentrated. All right, so the job of the vasorecta is to resorb as much water as possible. How does that happen? And is it under any kind of control? Well, we said that the proximal convoluted tubule is working all the time, can't be adjusted. But the function of the loop of Henle and collecting duct, it can be regulated by various things, including some hormones. So here's a hormone that I want to talk about next. It's called vasopressin. And you should all know vasopressin with another name. What else is vasopressin also called? Antidiuretic hormone. What does a diuretic do? It makes you lose water. A diuretic makes you lose water. What about an antidiuretic? Makes you retain water. So let's look at some how your body retains water with vasopressin. Vasopressin is a water-soluble hormone, right? So it's carried by the blood, diffuses out of the blood into this space. So here we have an interstitial space between the capillary and this wall of a kidney tubule. So this blue is the wall of the kidney tubule. And if we go over a little bit further, what is this space over here? So we have blood, we have interstitial fluid, we have cell volume, and another space. This is, we got to really understand this. This is the fluid that's inside a kidney tubule. What do we call that fluid inside a kidney tubule? That is filtrate, right? So here is filtrate inside a kidney tubule. If we leave whatever in here alone, where is it going to end up? If we just leave it alone, where is all this material in this kidney tubule going to end up? In urine, and when it's in urine, what do? We get it out of our body, right? So stuff that's in this compartment here is going to be lost, right? It's going to be put into urine, and we excrete that from our body, right? This blood is the stuff we want to keep in our body. So let's see what happens. So what does antidiuretic hormone do? Does it keep water in filtrate, or does it keep water in blood? Would be maybe a really simple way of thinking of it. Antidiuretic hormone is going to be a way of putting water in blood instead of filtrate. Let's see how that happens. Okay, so ADH, water soluble. So does that mean that ADH, can it enter the cell? Can a polar compound enter the cell?
No.
Right? Polar compounds can't get through the cell membrane because the cell membrane is nonpolar, right? Those phospholipids. So vasopressin cannot enter the cell, right? But the cell nonetheless is a target tissue or a target cell. So what does that mean?
It
if it's a target tissue for vasopressin? It has to have a receptor for vasopressin, and since vasopressin can't get inside the cell, where are we going to find that receptor? On the surface of the membrane of that cell. And indeed, here is that receptor. Here's the vasopressin receptor. When it binds, it's going to stimulate adenylate cyclase. Adenylate cyclase is going to take ATP and make cyclic AMP out of it. What do we call cyclic AMP? And what do we call vasopressin in this particular signal transduction scheme? Where do you always find cyclic AMP? Inside the cell. Where do you always find ADH? Outside. All right, so ADH is what we call the first messenger. Cyclic AMP is what we call the second messenger. Right? So when vasopressin or ADH binds to this membrane receptor, we have increases in cyclic AMP. That's going to change a number of functions inside the cell. All right, here we see a vesicle. And this vesicle we call an endosome. What do you know about an endosome? It's not so important about what's contained inside the vesicle. What's important are the things that are already embedded in the membrane of that vesicle. Remember, the GLUT4 transporters were reserved in endosomes. Here is another kind of transporter. We call this an aquaporin. And it's a pore for water. It allows water to move across this membrane. It's a membrane. Right? Because water can't freely move because water is polar. Membrane is nonpolar. So here is a channel for water to move across. So when vasopressin binds to the receptor, that's the signaling molecule that increases second messenger. Second messenger then is going to cause these endosomes to move over to the apical surface of the cell, and they're going to fuse together. So now where do we have these aquaporins as a result of vasopressin outside the cell? They are now inserted into the membrane of the cell. And so this is really handy because your cell doesn't have to build all of these aquaporins. They're already there inside the cell ready to go to work, but they need this signal, right? They need a vasopressin signal. So they're inserted into the cell membrane. It's a water pore, right? And so what happens to water? It's going to move by diffusion. Let's look at the diffusion gradient, right? And for diffusion requires a gradient. So here in the filtrate, we have 300 milliosmolar. Osmolar is what? A measure of water or solute in this solution right here. It's a measure of solute. That's right. So as this number goes up, that means that the solution becomes more salty, is what that means. All right, so filtrate, 300 milliosmolar inside the cell. It's 600 milliosmolar. Remember, that is the solute concentration, which means water concentration is decreasing. It's going the opposite way. So what will happen to water if there is a pore right here? It will move from high concentration to low concentration because the cell is saltier. And it can do that because of these aquaporins. All right. Okay. And then look what we have over here. What's the osmolality of blood in the medulla of the kidney, the special kind of nephron? It's 700 milliosmolar, which means what? Water is even at a lower concentration inside the blood. So what's going to happen to water? It's going to move from filtrate into the blood via these aquaporins. And so what happens to water? Does it stay in your body or does it end up in urine? It moves from filtrate into blood, right? That's what we call resorption. It's going to stay in your body, right? So vasopressin doesn't act like a diuretic. If it acted like a diuretic, water would stay in the filtrate or your body would actually put water into the filtrate. But vasopressin does the opposite thing. It helps your body conserve water, right? It puts water back into the blood that was filtered out. All right, so this is a really important exam figure because it shows you something about how polar signaling molecules work, right? There has to be membrane receptors for it and a second messenger that puts these aquaporins in so that water can diffuse just down its concentration gradient from filtrate back into the blood, right, in this particular peritubular capillary that we call the vasa recta. All right, so what's another name for vasopressin? Antidiuretic. So does this look like an antidiuretic to you when water goes from filtrate back into the blood? Yeah, that looks like an antidiuretic. What would a diuretic do? Which way would water move? From blood into filtrate, right? And then it would be lost in urine. That's what a diuretic would do, all right? So that's how ADH got its name. Let's look at another hormone that helps control, okay, urine formation. And we're sort of familiar with this one already because it's an important component of the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone mechanism. All right, so these two figures aren't in your book, but they're your exam figures, and the answer key is in your study guide. All right, so you can study these. I'll get this lecture online tonight really fast. Okay, so here's aldosterone. Tell me something about aldosterone. Where does it come from? Adrenal gland. Yeah, what part of the adrenal gland? Yeah, the cortex. Remember norepinephrine, epinephrine from the medulla, but aldosterone from the cortex. What else comes from the cortex? What other hormone? Cortisone is one, okay, and androgens. So what can you tell me about all of those compounds? What are they? They are steroids, right? And where does a steroid belong? Is it a protein or a carbohydrate or a lipid? It's a lipid, right? So do lipids like to dissolve in water? No, okay, they don't really like to dissolve in water. So there are carrier proteins in blood that help aldosterone dissolve into blood. But since aldosterone is a nonpolar compound, it can actually diffuse across cell membranes by itself because the cell membrane is the like polarity, right? They're both nonpolar. So here we have aldosterone. It can diffuse out of the blood. And look at that. It can even diffuse inside the cell. Why can it diffuse inside the cell unlike ADH? Because it is nonpolar. So where are the receptors for aldosterone? Are they outside the cell or inside? They're inside because it is a nonpolar compound. So nonpolar signaling compounds have cytoplasmic receptors. Oh, and look at that. That's exactly where we see this receptor for aldosterone. It's inside the cytoplasm. We said way before when we looked at hormones that cytoplasmic receptors, when they're bound to their signaling compounds, can act as transcription factors. What is transcription? You got to remember what transcription is. It's a part of something we call protein synthesis. How many steps does protein synthesis have? Two. It's got transcription and translation. Which one comes first? Yeah, just like we said, a transcription comes first, right? Okay, so here we have the receptor that's bound to aldosterone, moves into the nucleus, it works on the DNA via a process called transcription. So what does transcription produce? You just told me it's the first step of protein synthesis. That first step of protein synthesis, transcription produces messenger RNA, right? So DNA is used as a template to make messenger RNA. It diffuses out of the cell, and then that messenger RNA is used to make up protein. What do we call information in messenger RNA converted into information in a protein? That's what we call, that's translation, right? Going from one language, an RNA language, to an amino acid language, that's translation, right? So aldosterone increases protein synthesis because it acts as a transcription factor. Well, what are some of the proteins that are made? Well, it can make more pumps, sodium potassium pumps, right? That's a protein, and those are put into the basal surface of this epithelium. It can make new channels, various kinds of channels. So these channels right here are proteins, and they can be regulated. So here's a gated channel, for instance. And it can even make proteins that will regulate this channel, maybe open it or close it, right? So there are a number of different kinds of proteins, and when their concentrations are changed, the physiology of the cell changes. All right, so let's take a look. So aldosterone increases transcription, makes new proteins. These proteins can, if it's a regulator, modulator type of protein, it can open a potassium channel, right? Or it can open a sodium channel, or maybe both of these. And it can also make more of these channels that can open up. All right, well, let's consider potassium. Where's potassium at a high concentration? Inside the cell, right? It's going to be low in the filtrate, so which way is potassium going to diffuse? From high inside the cell to low into, well, what's this compartment again over here? This is the filtrate. This is inside a kidney tubule. So potassium, right, if it ends up in the filtrate, eventually where is it going to end up? Filtrate, urine, out of your body, right? So you're going to lose that potassium. So we call this secretion. When your body puts potassium into the filtrate, when it's being lost, that's called secretion. So aldosterone increases what? Potassium secretion, increases potassium loss from your body. Here is a sodium channel. Where is sodium at a low concentration? You just told me that potassium is high inside the cell. What about sodium? It's high outside, but low inside, right? So it's high outside, low inside. So which way is sodium going to move by diffusion? It's going to go from the filtrate back into this epithelial cell. We don't call that secretion, right? Secretion is the opposite direction. We call that resorption, right? So sodium is being resorbed into this cell, right? But we're interested in the blood because that's really inside our body. So how does this cell maintain high potassium concentration and low sodium? If potassium is leaving because of these pores that were put in the membrane and sodium is entering, how does your cell maintain a low sodium concentration here inside the cell? Look what we have right here. What do we call this thing? This is your old familiar sodium potassium ATP pump. And what kind of and it's active transport. So it can move potassium from low concentration in this interstitial fluid to high concentration inside the cell, which is what you would expect, right? Potassium is low outside, potassium is high inside the cell. The sodium potassium ATP pump, right, make sure that that happens. But what's the cost? Is there any cost to the cell when that happens? Is it active or passive? Active. And what kind of active process is it? It's primary active transport, right? That sodium potassium ATP pump. All right, so that's going to pump potassium in. What else is it going to do? It's going to pump sodium out, right? And when we say pump, it's going to move something from low concentration to high. All right, so sodium is going to be low inside the cell, but it's still going to be kicked out by this pump. That's okay because that is an active transport pump, primary active transport. All right, so now we have high sodium in this interstitial fluid. It can move into the blood, okay, and be just down a concentration gradient. So we have sodium moving from the filtrate back into the blood. We call that resorption. What about potassium? Is it moving the same way or the opposite way? Opposite way. It's moving from blood to filtrate. All right, so does that seem so strange that the effects of aldosterone would be sodium resorption and potassium secretion at the same time? What's the fundamental mechanism where potassium is being secreted while sodium is being resorbed at the same time? That's the effect of aldosterone. And why does it have to be that effect? Because what is it dependent on? Aldosterone is dependent on something you learned about months ago, namely the sodium potassium ATP pump. All right, so next time somebody asks you, maybe on a test, board exam or something, what's the effect of aldosterone? What's the first thing you should think of? Sodium and potassium, and what about sodium and potassium? Same direction? Opposite direction, and why is that? Because of the sodium potassium ATP pump. That's just how it's all set up to work, just because of that pump right there. Right, and then think of this diagram, and you can see potassium leaving the body and sodium entering from the filtrate. So that's why we say aldosterone promotes potassium secretion, but sodium resorption. Just with this figure right there. All right, so that's, and these two figures are important because it ties together a lot of the physical chemistry and biochemistry that you learn through the whole class. And so that's it for lecture. Okay? That's it. Except for next time. What are you going to remember next time? Besides all the right answers for the exam. Yeah, Scantron, pencil, eraser, right, and picture ID. I will give your picture ID back to you after the test. 20 is reproductive system? Yes, you have that one figure that you draw today on the test and some questions at the end of the chapter. That's in Blackboard, on the very first page of Blackboard. Let me get out of here. Hold on. That's a good question. I'll show you where that is.